This is November 26th, 2016, the day of our Jukai, receiving the precept ceremony. And also, I remember this morning, it's my 40-year anniversary as a priest. 40 years ago, I was ordained on this day. The challenge for me today is to comment on the precepts, the ceremony, without completely repeating myself from the, 30 times, at least 75 teshos I've given on the precepts. Your challenge, anyone who's listening, is to listen as if for the first time. That's our challenge anyway for everything we do in Zen practice, is make it the first time. And that simply comes from attention, not letting the mind wander. So the 16 precepts begin with the three, arguably the most important, the three refuges, which we do all the time, every day we do here at the center, usually along with prostrations. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. Then there are the three resolutions, and then there are the 10 cardinal precepts. And before all this comes, we do the repentance ceremony to get a fresh start. Some general things about the three refuges. they're the most important because they are so encompassing of everything we're doing in Zen practice. When we say, I take refuge in Buddha, we're really saying, I take refuge in my Buddha nature. Maybe someday we'll change this to, I take refuge in my Buddha nature, or I take refuge in my true self. It doesn't exclude placing one's faith in the Buddha Shakyamuni, the man, the person. He kind of embodies Buddha nature realized, but it's extremely important, I feel, to whenever we use this word Buddha, to realize we're really talking about our self nature, our essential nature, our original nature. the original Sanskrit, or maybe it's Pali, of take refuge, is the root meaning is protection or shelter or abode, and that plus I will undertake. So it really means I undertake to find my home, find refuge in my Buddha nature, not in my small self and its self-interests, but in that which is most true about me, my true nature, but it's most pure and noble, that which is grounded in wisdom and compassion, to act, to speak out of this original nature. That's what we're really saying when we say, I take refuge in Buddha. The implication also is that by finding my home, my refuge in Buddha and Dharma and Sangha, I can find liberation. I can liberate myself from the shackles of ego, have often said that this is considered Jukai, taking the precepts, is considered the most important ceremony of any in Buddhism, except monastic ordination. Here at the Zen Center, and I think some other centers, we see Jukai, taking the precepts, as something that is accessible to everyone. It is open to everyone. In fact, Roshi Kapa used to say, let's let people walk in off the street who want to take these 16 precepts. This is very different from the way it is at many other Zen centers, where taking the precepts, or Jukai, is considered the equivalent of becoming ordained. I think that's true of almost all Zen centers, at least Soto Zen centers, where you go through a long preparation. It's a much more demanding in ceremony in terms of the preparation for it, months of study and other things. In order to take Jukai, you have to sow a rock soon. But then once you come out of it, out of the ceremony, with a shaved head, then you're considered ordained. And once you're ordained, then that's the primary requirement, prerequisite for becoming a teacher. It's stunning to think that that would be the primary requirement instead of, say, awakening to one's true nature. But it is broadly the only real... That, of course, plus many years of practice, experience. Here, ordination, just to finish this up, ordination requires making a pledge to make this your vocation, that you do this full-time. You do, that is, Zen practice and training full-time. You devote the rest of your life to the Dharma in that you are doing this full-time at a Dharma center. There are times of exception when one may, in order to support oneself, have to supplement one's income some other way. If one is in a very small sangha and one can't be supported enough, there can be other exceptions to that. But generally, we have that very much stiffer requirements for ordination as with becoming a teacher. But here, Jukai, taking the precepts, is something you can do over and over and over again. And each time, it can be more meaningful. We have this ceremony twice a year. This is the main one. This is the fullest, most complete Jukai ceremony. And then we have a somewhat stripped-down version in the spring, and as a way of the sort of the finale for the Friday night temple night. We have a Jukai ceremony, but this is the big one, and yet you can take it over and over again. In some Buddhist countries, they have a custom of doing this, the precept ceremony, on solemn occasions more frequently, such as the first and the 15th days of the lunar month. I dug up these words of Zen Master Dogen, the great 13th century Japanese Zen master. You have to sort of roll with the 13th century language here, but he says, even though we may be led astray by bad friends or devils, with the result that we stop doing good and lose all hope of realizing enlightenment, still the merit of having previously taken refuge in the three treasures will continue to increase, and eventually we will resume doing good, ultimately realizing enlightenment. So if I can sell people who are on the fence about coming this afternoon, if I can sell you on coming to this ceremony, I would very much love to do that. The ceremony only takes maybe 30-35 minutes, but it can have such an impact if done with one's whole being. We'll get more to that. We'll say more about that later. And although technically this ceremony is a way of confirming one's Buddhism, you don't have to be a Buddhist to do this. You don't have to consider yourself a Buddhist. I know from my own dim memories that people who start this practice may not be completely at ease with the term Buddhism or thinking of themselves as Buddhist. Well, don't then, but come to the ceremony, and you may find more in it than you thought. And then when you leave, don't consider yourself a Buddhist if you don't, but you will have taken the ceremony. And then the second and third refuges, I take refuge in Dharma, just the way. The Tao is another word for it, the law, the truth. I won't go into any more of that because I've so often talked about it. And the Sangha. The Sangha is the community, community of people who practice with us. And most widely speaking, the community of anyone who is sincerely trying to get beyond just narrow self-interest. Then after the three refuges, here's one other little point with regard to the connection between the taking refuge in the three treasures, three refuges, and the Four Noble Truths. Most of you know the Four Noble Truths is comprised the Buddha's first formal discourse after his great enlightenment. And the first of those four is that suffering is pervasive. And a way to understand this in terms of taking the precepts is so long as we rely or take refuge in the things of the world rather than the three treasures, we will be left wanting. This is an important point. If we place our faith in all of the dualistic values that most people do, gain and loss and winning and losing and everything else like that, then we will be left frustrated, wanting, not at peace. But taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha leads to liberation from the state of wanting. Now, the three revolutions... Three resolutions. I do have something new to offer in this teisho on the three resolutions, which is a change in wording. The first of the three is we've always done for now 50 years is a resolve to avoid evil, and that for about almost 50 years that word evil has stuck in my craw because it's so extreme. And to say I resolve to avoid evil is not setting a very high bar. Okay, I resolve not to murder people. I resolve not to, whatever. And so finally, I've been turning this over in my mind for years. I tend to be conservative about these things. This is the most widely used translation. Everything's a translation in Buddhism, of course, because this all comes from ancient times. And evil is the word that you usually see. But I want to throw it overboard starting today and raise the bar and say I resolve to avoid wrong. I've considered all kinds of other words. I've opened the thesaurus. I've meditated on this. And I think it really comes down to wrong or wrongdoing. I resolve to avoid wrongdoing. I think the doing isn't necessary. The word wrong is, yes, it's also a dualistic word like evil. But it's also a simple word, one syllable that covers a lot. I tried out something else in September when I went to our Cleveland Zazen group and did a weekend intensive there. We had Jukai. And I tried out, I resolved to avoid doing harm. I think the original, I resolve to avoid evil, it covers more territory than doing. It's not just doing. You could understand I resolve to avoid evil as steer clear of places where evil happens, even if you're not doing it. So we're going to give this a try today. We've changed the little slips of paper that we hand out to people. Hopefully one or two of us will remember the change as we're doing it. I resolve to avoid wrong. The second one, I resolve to do good. I'm not thrilled with that either, the implications of being a do-gooder. But that's, I find, even harder to change. So for now, we're going to stick with that. I resolve to do good. And the third is I resolve to liberate all sentient beings. Or living beings, I think we made it, to make it different from the third of the three refuges. These are just two sides of one coin. I resolve to avoid wrong, and I resolve to do good. I think of the Buddha's words, some of my favorite of all of his many words, is when he said, the mind is pure and self-luminous in its nature, but it is stained by adventitious defilements. So here, of course, we're talking about our essential nature. The mind is pure and self-luminous in its nature, but it is stained by adventitious. Adventitious just means it's not intrinsic to us. Things that come and go. It's stained by adventitious defilements. So when we are avoiding wrong, we are not succumbing to these defilements. But when we do good, we're living out of our true nature. Another way to understand doing good is acting or speaking or thinking in which there is the absence of greed, anger, and delusion. These are the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. They cover, like a million other afflictions. But they've always been, in Buddhism, they've always been summed up. All of our many faults and stains can be fall into this basket of deplorables. of greed, anger, and delusion. More about that later when we mention repentance. This resolution to do good is acting out of the understanding that all existences are indivisible. We're all one. There is no thing apart from every other thing. When we act out of that, we do good. We're doing good. And the third one, a resolve to liberate all living beings. Yasutani Roshi says, this is the manifestation of the mind of compassion. These three, a resolve to avoid wrong, a resolve to do good, a resolve to liberate all living beings, are the big basket of precepts. And then they're articulated. These three are articulated in the 10 cardinal precepts. Before we go to the 10 cardinal precepts, in our precept ceremony, we recite the three refuges and the three resolutions three times, three sets of these. Why? For the same reason that we do so many vows in Zen, why we do them three times, because by the third time, we're more likely to really take them to heart as we're saying them. So the first time that you say, you know, I take refuge in Buddha, you're more likely to have your mind wandering and thinking about the person sitting next to you or what you're going to make for dinner or this or that. The second time, you can sort of get a new purchase on it, try to get your mind to what you're doing. And the third time, most likely, is your best shot at really taking that precept, resolve. I take refuge in Buddha, my Buddha nature. So we keep getting, you know, in all of these things, we get second and third chances to get our mind on it. It goes deeper each time, theoretically. The 10 cardinal precepts, we go through them just once. They're pretty long. And maybe I'm afraid that if we did those three times, we'd cut down on attendance at the... It'd be an extra 5 minutes that people would be trapped in the Buddha hall. So going right on to those, the 10 cardinal precepts. The first is a resolve not to kill but to cherish all life. Now, the most important thing I hope you could take away from this as far as the precepts is that the precepts are not principally about right and wrong, being good or being bad. And that's what we're up against with this whole matter of morality, the precepts in Buddhism, is that it's hard for us in our culture to get free of our conditioning of judgmentalism, starting with the self, judging ourselves, judging others. We have this template of the Abrahamic religions that we lay on top of all these matters of the whole matter of the precepts, and we can only wonder how many layers of that we have absorbed in our lives. And that's something we can't just make up our mind that we're going to lose that conditioning. That's what takes years and years of practice. But until we lose it, if that's even possible in our culture, then to be aware that it's really, these precepts are about causation. It means that we try to uphold the precepts in order to minimize harm. We're trying to stop hurting people and ourselves, people and ourselves, same thing. If we can think of it that way, We don't need right and wrong. It's just cutting down on the pain we cause ourselves and others. Causation. It's more like science than religion. And also, another way to understand it is upholding the precepts is a way to live in freedom. Freedom from our cravings. Freedom from, our greed, anger, and delusion. Freedom from the bondage of our self-interest, our ego interest. Now, since this is ostensibly a matter of morality, the ceremony that we're taking, we're dealing with what is possibly the most complex matter of anything in the world. Moral decision making. Ethical issues that we know can be exceedingly difficult or elusive to sort through. And in Buddhism we recognize this, we recognize the complexity of the precepts, that we can see them as having three levels to them. Living by the precepts can be just in a literal sense, which is the most narrow, limited kind of way of understanding them. The second level is what could call the compassionate or the Mahayana level. Is it where you look at the greater good, not just whether you should do something. The example I always give, because I'm too lazy to come up with another one, is the rabid dog, which would apply to the first precept, I resolve, and not to kill. A rabid dog, looking at the precept literally, if you saw a dog foaming at the mouth, charging into a playground, and you had a shotgun, you would refrain from shooting the dog, and might see several children bitten and die. This is what happened to one of our members, Mitra Bishop, who lived in Burma many years ago, actually saw this happen, where, and this is the Theravadan literal interpretation, no one would shoot the dog, and that was the result. So that would be the literal. The Mahayana level, say the compassionate level, is where you look at the bigger picture. And then there's the essential level. This is the third. The essential, I always have difficulty trying to find time to carve out time for that, because it is transmoral, and it is what is beyond any even causation. Causation itself is still on the level of the relative world, of the phenomenal world. The essential point is where there's no killing, there's no one killing, there's nothing being killed, and therefore there is no killing. And this is so advanced, this perspective. It really takes enlightenment to appreciate it, and until then, one can abuse it by as long as you're one with some kind of activity, as long as you're one with, while you're having sex with another man's wife, that you're okay, you're in the clear, because there's no thought of self or other. This is most painfully obvious in the history of Zen and warfare in Japan, where more Zen teachers than would ever want to admit were on board during World War II they were all in for the war. Harada Roshi himself said, when shooting, just bang, bang. When marching, just tromp, tromp. So it can be abused, this idea, as long as you're one with something, beyond thoughts of self or other or doing, then you're in the clear. You're not violating. So I'm just going to skip over that, say nothing more about that level, but the other two is something we all can struggle with, the literal or the compassionate, or the greater good. And then to further complicate these matter of the precepts, we can violate them or not violate them in terms of conduct, in terms of our words, or even our thoughts. That would be, the latter especially, would be the most, absolutely most strict way of interpreting these precepts. And that's what it comes down to. It's we can lay out all these precepts, but then it's a matter of interpreting them that falls to each one of us. And it's not something that our teachers can lay out in black and white terms. It so much depends on the time, that is the era or the contemporary mores, the time, the place, the position, the relative positions of the actors, and the degree to which one is acting or speaking. Let me go through those again because it gives us a sense of how complex all this is in understanding the precepts. The time, you know, what is prohibited today, 30 years ago, or certainly 100 or 200 years ago, may have been perfectly acceptable. There's no ultimate cosmic agreement on what causes harm and what doesn't. I mean, there isn't complete agreement on what causes harm and what doesn't. Agreement across cultures and times. So we have to draw from this time, this century, or this decade, the place that can vary, you know, in some remote parts of the world, they have a whole different consensus about what causes harm and what doesn't. And then the position of the actors, what a teacher might do with a student, it would be different standards, different criteria, moral criteria, than what someone else might do with someone. And then the degree. Time, place, position, degree. So let's just plow into this again, this first precept, resolve not to kill but to cherish all life. I'm going to go to some of the trickier issues. And one that came to mind because I read about it and have struggled with it myself is slapping mosquitoes. Yeah, if you a really strict interpretation of the precept is that to slap a mosquito is a violation of the precept. But then, short of that kind of interpretation, is there ever a time when one could do it without violence? Maybe not. Maybe in any situation where you slap a mosquito, that's a violation of the precept. Getting into the matter of degree, I'll just share a personal thing. I sometimes find myself at our annual work retreat at Chapin Mill being pestered by a deer fly. That's these vicious flies that have kind of the delta-shaped wings, and they can zoom down and without you even noticing leave a bite that you'll have for days. And I've slapped one. All right, more than one. And doing that, I know that there is at some level there's some kind of karmic retribution, but I'm willing to suffer that in the future just to get that damn thing off my neck. But I think it's important to recognize that no matter how small a thing it may seem to us, that yes, there will, because it's causation. It's what goes around comes around. Every little act that we perform, no matter how small, will have ripples, will have an effect that will be visited upon us in the future to some one degree or another. Vegetarianism. I find it hard to argue that eating meat is not in any sense a violation of this precept. Roshi Kapil was very strict about this. Not all Zen teachers would agree with me on this. There was the late John Dietl Lorry, who was the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery in the Catskills, once very forcefully said in one of our Zen teachers' meetings, he said, this has nothing to do with the first precept, vegetarianism, eating meat. But, okay, that's his point of view, but how can we deny that when we eat meat, there is complicity with slaughter? Now, there too, it doesn't mean you're going to suffer in hell because you eat meat, but there's probably going to be some kind of effect up the road of buying into the slaughter industry, not to mention the global warming issue. You see, from time to time, I've seen lists, two different organizations that say, what are the 10 things that you as an individual can do for your part in mitigating the effects of global warming, climate change? And number one on the list is adopt a vegetarian diet because of the generation of methane and nitrous oxide that comes from the livestock industry. But we make our decisions. People who know who've been to a workshop, I guess you all have, but who've been to a workshop with me know that I take Roshi Kapil's advice. I offer up Roshi Kapil's advice in saying, don't give up meat, let meat give you up. As a general principle, it doesn't work to give up something until we're ready to. So we take our chances. And it's also good, I think, with this to recognize that just because 99%, or maybe it's 97% now, percent of our fellow countrymen eat meat, doesn't mean that it doesn't create painful karma in doing so. Seneca, the great Roman philosopher, said, there's no safety in following the crowd. And just to finish up with the vegetarianism thing, there's never been a time or a place, I think, anywhere in the world, and in this century, there's no time it's been so easy to stick to non-meat food with Wegmans and other supermarkets. Abortion is another sticky wicket. You can't deny that abortion involves the taking of life, but there are other considerations, the mother's life, and in any case, I feel strongly that that's the mother's decision, maybe the mother and the father together, but above all, the mother's decision, and the state should not be involved in it. The second precept, I resolve not to take what is not given. There are other translations of this that say, I resolve not to steal, but we've always used this one because it's more strict. You could tell yourself, all right, I'm not, you know, when I'm Cheating on my taxes, you know, when I go out to lunch for fun with someone and I chalk it up as a professional expense. I'm not stealing exactly, but you are taking what is not given. When you borrow a book and keep it indefinitely, or you borrow a book without asking and keep it indefinitely, that would be taking what is not given. When you take from something from lost and found because you figure, okay, it's been there long enough, in my view, that I'll just consider it a donation, that's taking without... These are the strict interpretations of this. And then there's a much broader way to understand taking what is not given as exploiting the natural world for short-term benefit to a so-called fortunate minority. And that gets you into a huge thicket, ethical thicket of what is, how to proceed when you see how interconnected everything is, the world is, and how our decisions we make in consuming things, buying products, can have such effects in a much wider scale. Third precept, I resolve not to misuse sexuality, but to be caring and responsible. The standard modern understanding of that is three-part. Adultery would be a violation of that precept. Second is having sex with an underage person. And the third is having sex with someone who is not in his or her right mind, or someone who is developmentally disabled or somehow mentally disturbed. Those are the obvious ones. But then we can go so far beyond that in terms of what is misusing sexuality. You get into porn, pornography. People can say, well, it's not hurting anyone. Really? All those women, primarily, who are doing that, they're not suffering, you're not contributing, somehow complicit in their suffering. The fifth, resolve not to cause others to abuse alcohol or drugs, nor to do so myself, but to keep the mind clear. You see the emphasis there on first the primacy of causing others to abuse alcohol or drugs. This points to the Mahayana, the concern about others, the greater number. And this would, I think there's just no way to rationalize anything but to rationalize being a bartender. That's causing others to at least, if you're going to be a bartender, at least set the limit for them when you see that they're going beyond, they're about to go beyond the limit. But beyond this, a much stricter interpretation of abusing alcohol and drugs is any of the many, many other kinds of addictive behaviors that are available to us as never before. Addiction to the internet, addiction to pornography. Whoops, I skipped number four. I'll go back to it in a second. Addiction to shopping and to music and to tobacco and to computer games and TV and coffee and sweets and. In all of these, of course, here the degree is important. Some of these cause a lot less harm than potentially than drunkenness or alcohol abuse, but they all really are under the same umbrella as where the mind is not free. The mind is caught. One is caught. Back to number four, resolve not to lie but to speak the truth. This is a huge one. I just did a whole keisho on it, I think last year maybe, and based on a whole book on lying I read, honesty. Just one word on that. It comes down, most of it comes down to self-deception. Not just deceiving others, but self-deception. But beyond that, it really means any complicity in lying. Maybe lying in advertising, lying in politics. It's based, the key thing here is whether it is for one's own sake, out of one's own self-interest, or rather it's to spare the feelings of another. There's big times when telling a white lie, I would see it as not a violation of this precept if it's based on protecting others, avoiding unnecessary suffering. Someone once said, people who are brutally honest get more satisfaction out of the brutality than out of the honesty. There is a new kind of ethos about honesty, relatively new, that I find really a misunderstanding, where the more honesty, the better. You see parents being honest with their, revealing things with their kids that the kids aren't ready to hear, I believe, and making an absolute out of honesty, I think, is can be misguided. Precepts 6 and 7, moving right along here, precepts 6 and 7 are so similar, I'm still not sure why they're different, listed differently. I resolve not to speak of the faults of others, but to be understanding and sympathetic is 6. And 7, very similar, is I resolve not to praise myself and disparage others. And these and number 4, resolve not to lie, might be the hardest for most people. 4, 6, and 7. Now, one exception to this might be speaking of the faults of others, is I face this sometimes when people will ask me about a certain Zen teacher who I know is an inveterate predator and usually a drunk on top of that. And someone will innocently ask, well, I find that the center closest to me is such and such a place where I know that teacher is teaching. What do you think? And I've struggled with it because I just feel when I speak ill of that teacher, I feel kind of diminished myself. Feels kind of not good to say that, but from the level of the higher level of compassion, of the greater good, I could see myself, luckily I haven't faced this very often, I could see myself saying, look, this is someone who we've heard of for 40 years as being exploiting his students. I would feel I should say that. Roshi Kapalo used to quote Yasudhani Roshi as saying, the job of a teacher is not just to reveal the truth, but to expose the false. I think you can go too far in that, but it's an ongoing negotiation as situations arise. And then 8, not to withhold spiritual or material aid. We don't have time to get into that. I have at least notes on that. It's maybe 9th, I have the most notes, not to indulge in anger, but to exercise forbearance. I gave 3 consecutive teishos on this anger one, so I'm not going to try to plunge into that. And number 10, not to revile the 3 treasures. This is also a really comprehensive one. So, for example, when we are speaking of the faults of others or praising myself and disparaging others, we're violating this precept. Reviling the three treasures, we're reviling our own Buddha nature when we disparage others. And you can see that another all really, this covers the previous nine of reviling Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. As usual, the last three or four precepts get short shrift in these teishos. But just to wrap up here, a general thing about upholding the precepts, it requires mindfulness. We have to catch it before we speak or act. And that's where the Zazen is so essential, is the more sitting we do, the more frequently, the more regularly we sit, the more likely we're going to catch ourselves before violating one of these precepts. And then, as a prelude to the 16 precepts, we have the repentance ceremony, simple repentance ceremony. This is can be so gratifying if your mind is free of thoughts and you're really into it, one with it. And then I always like to advise people to sit beforehand. Anything we do that is preceded by sitting is going to be more meaningful. Eating, watching football, anything we do we're going to be into it more if we sit first. So I do encourage people to come sit either here before this afternoon ceremony or sit at home, but and also this sounds small, but to shower, to bathe or shower beforehand. You know, we do that before going to a wedding or a party or something. Well, since this is arguably the most important ceremony in Buddhism, we can spring for a shower before coming here. All right, we're over our time. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless wine passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the proven way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the great endless mind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the proven way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the bright, endless, blind passions. I bow to the uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha.